So I'd like to begin the talk this evening by reading, sharing with you a poem by a poet called Fernando Pessoa from a collection of poems with the very humble title of A Little Larger Than the Entire Universe. So the poem is, "Beyond the bend in the road, there may be a well, and there may be a chateau, and there may be just more road. I don't know, and don't ask. As long as I'm on the road before the bend, I only look at the road before the bend, because the road before the bend is all I can see. It would do me no good to look anywhere else, or at what I can't see. Let's pay attention only to where we are. There's enough beauty in simply being here and not somewhere else. If there are people beyond the bend in the road, let them worry about what's beyond the bend in the road. That, for them, is the road. If we're to arrive there, when we arrive, there we'll know. For now, we only know that we're not there. Here, there's just the road before the bend, and before the bend, there's the road without any bend." I find this poem in some way captures the beauty of what it means to be present, to be the wholehearted sense of being here. And you may have caught glimpses of that over these 2 days. That when you are really totally, wholeheartedly here, how the world seems to open for you. It describes an embodied way of being present, of not leaning back into the past with regret or with if only, and not leaning forward with anxiety or anticipation or longing into the future. The Buddha describes this as one fortunate attachment. I think the poem also captures a sense of easefulness, of being able to rest in not knowing. Not knowing what the next moment will bring. Not knowing how the next moment in our life will unfold. And then the poem describes also resting in this quality of wakefulness, of mindfulness, that illuminates, lights up the world, both inwardly and outwardly. And I'm sure you have also had moments of seeing this here. How you can go out into your walking path when the mind is very full and overflowing. And you can come back in and realize you haven't been touched by anything at all. And how in another moment you can go out onto your walking path with that sense of wakefulness and that sense of mindfulness and how it seems to bring the world to life and how you see wholeheartedly, you're touched wholeheartedly. And it's almost like the world comes alive for you. This quality of wakefulness is what allows us to be touched deeply by the sorrows in the world, but also by the beauty in the world that gladdens our hearts. When I read this poem, I hear in it what the Buddha describes of the freedom, the liberation that comes when we are no longer in debt. Debt? When we're no longer in debt. And the Buddha obviously wasn't speaking about financial debt. He was often speaking about emotional and psychological debt. And actually, we know what we are in debt to, because this is what our attention keeps returning to, obsessing about, the things that feel undone, the things we have regret over, the things that we feel that we carry with us in our life that are somehow incomplete. You can feel the debt of that, the weight of that. And the Buddha often speaks about freedom. It's about learning this freedom from being in debt and feeling the weight of that incompletion, those shoulds, those regrets, those guilts beginning to fall away. It's about not being obsessed. It's about not being preoccupied with past and future. It's about no longer being weighed down by what has already gone by or what is yet to come. And yet, from another perspective, when I read this poem, it almost seems kind of simplistic. You know, as if mindfulness, being mindfully present, is going to be the cure for all the afflictions in our life and the afflictions in the world. And in reality, the journey of our lives has really been a long and winding road. You know, moments of joy, moments of sorrow, moments of hope, moments of disappointment, moments of coming together, moments of losing. We have our personal story. And our story is interwoven with the story of the people who have touched our lives and that we have touched, both the people we love and care for and the people that we struggle with. You have probably come to notice how much we live in our stories, how much we live in our narratives about who we are, about who others are, about what the world is. You probably notice that background chatter of the storyteller trying to make meaning of every moment, having a commentary about so many things that really don't ask for a commentary. And yet how we often seem to be almost infatuated with, almost hypnotized by the stories that we are telling inwardly. And we begin to appreciate that our stories are self-makers. Our stories are identity makers. And our stories also are the ways that we make the other and how we know the other. And our narrative and our story, of course, shapes our present. It shapes our choices. Our story shapes our actions, our speech, our views. Our story shapes our sense of possibility and our sense of limitation. And our stories, in very many ways, really shape how we stand on the road that we are on just now. But we see that our stories don't stand alone, that our stories are interwoven with the stories of others, that none of us lives in a bubble, none of us lives in isolation, that in every moment of experience, we are touching the world and we're being touched by the world. There's that wonderful, wonderful quote that says that all that we are now is a result of all that we were. And all that we will be in the future, even in the next moment, will be the result of all that we are now. In many ways, we see how we are the children of the conditions in our lives, our families, our societies, our educations, our cultures. We are the children of all of those conditions. Have you ever found yourself or asked yourself, you know, why do I think the way I do? You know, why do I have the preferences that I have? You know, where did the views that I have actually come from? You know, do you ever think, like, why do I act the way that I do? And we see that from the moment of our birth, really our sense of self has been shaped not only by the experiences of our lives, but by the endless stream of messages that we have absorbed from our culture, our society, our families, by how we've been seen and how we've been treated by others. You know, I was born into a family where, I could say a lot about the family I was born into, but one thing that stood out in the family that I was born into is that my father preferred boys. My father still prefers boys. When his grandchildren are expecting babies, he says, it's all right as long as it's a boy. He's 93 years old. There's some things that haven't been learnt in this life. So with a father who preferred boys, that of course really shaped how myself and my sister were actually treated. You know, my brother, of course, was, you know, the god in the household. My sister and I were the maid servants, you know. So, you know, this is a message you receive at a very young age, you know, that begins to shape how you see yourself, how you see your place in the world. How people see us is how they treat us. How we see other people is how we treat them. There's something very important to learn in this. The Buddha deeply emphasized the need to be wakefully present in our life. Not because there's something intrinsically valuable about the present moment. I think that gets overhyped a little bit. It's not because there's something intrinsically valuable about the present moment, but because being present holds the potential to be a turning point in all of that conditioning, in all of those views. The present moment, if we are awake here, can be an embarkation point on a journey of profound transformation. It's a place where we can begin to explore what it means to be no longer bound by the past. The place where we begin to explore what it means to be no longer a prisoner of the world of conditions. It's a place where we can begin to break the repetitive psychological and emotional habit patterns that lead us to keep reanimating and reliving the past in the present. Wherever we are and whatever we do, I think we bring with us the entirety of our lives. The question I think that's important is how much do we feel bound by the entirety of our lives so far? And how much do we feel free? Because we see, as I mentioned last night, it is so easy simply to be a collection of habit patterns, isn't it, that we repeat over and over again. And we are prone to repeat the difficult ones, you know, the anxieties, the worries, the ruminations, the judgments, the aversion patterns. They can feel so familiar, as if they're, you know, this is actually what makes up our sense of who we are. And we are, you know, we actually see that the nature of habit is that it asks to be repeated. It's the nature of habit, is that it asks to be repeated. And whatever we practice and repeat, we get better at. and it deepens. And we see it doesn't take much effort to relapse into default modes of doubt and fear and aversion. We don't have to work at this very hard. It's much of this path is actually concerned with emerging from this condition of chronic relapse. To find the ways to walk new pathways of respect, of dignity. And it really does take much more dedication and much more commitment to really foster and nourish that which serves us well. You know, it takes much more commitment and dedication in my experience, you know, to really nourish and to really develop and to really cultivate the seeds of potential we have, the seeds of capacity that we have for very profound kindness, very profound compassion and joyfulness and empathy and appreciation. But this is what we turn our attention to. We see how in the face of injustice or harm or the ignorance in the world, how much more challenging it is to meet that with courage and compassion than with fear and rage. And it takes a lot more effort to travel lightly in this world with integrity and balance rather than with heedlessness and forgetfulness. And we see this in our practice here. Which is why this evening what I'd really like to talk about, which I haven't mentioned yet, is karma. Or kama. But let's use the word karma, because I think that's the word that we're probably the most familiar with. I think this is probably one of the most misunderstood and misused words from the Buddhist teaching. You know, we often hear karma as a kind of fatalism or as a kind of determinism. You know, if something terrible happens to you, you know, you get struck with some terrible illness, you know, you tell yourself, or worse still, somebody tells you, oh, it's just my karma, it's just your karma. Sometimes the word karma is even heard as a kind of a retribution or a form of punishment. You know, if something terrible happens, well, you must have done something to deserve it. You know? And for centuries in parts of Asia, this was a kind of social control. You know, people had duties. You had the duty to maintain your class, or the duty to maintain your caste, hierarchies. You know, it was your karma to be born into a family who were potters or butchers or toilet cleaners or priests. You know, you had a duty to undertake certain tasks to occupy yourself with. And practically, it maintained a position in social hierarchies. You see this in parts of Southeast Asia, you know, in Buddhist cultures, you know, where, you know, it's your karma to be born as a woman, you know, so you can't be awakened. And the way you're going to be awakened is by serving the monks, so you get a better rebirth as a man and can be awakened. Well, that's handy, isn't it? Keeps the wheel turning, doesn't it? Keeps the monasteries clean and the vegetables chopped, you know, and it's pretty handy kind of belief system, you know, and yet it's kind of awful to see how it gets absorbed. You know, I've recently heard about a group of nuns from a temple in Korea who wear men's underwear because they believe that by wearing men's underwear, they're going to be reborn as a man and get awakened. Well, you know, I don't think this is what the Buddha taught about karma. I don't think underwear came into this, you know. In our cultures, sometimes people are told to know your place. This was very handy in the class system in England. You know your place, you know. Don't reach too high, you know. Don't grow too big for your shoes, you know. Know your place. It's all very handy, isn't it? in terms of maintaining hierarchies and in terms of maintaining, you know, superiority and inferiority. And all of it rests upon a really faulty understanding of karma. There was a student of the Buddha called Sivaka. And he went to the Buddha and he said, some teachers say that everything that we experience, pleasant or painful, is because of past deeds. Is this true? The Buddha's answer, no, this is not true. Some of what you experience is simply the result of phlegm. Phlegm in German? Mucus. Slime. Some of what you experience is simply the result of slime. Some is the result of bile. Some of what you experience is a result of internal winds. Some of what you experience is a combination of body humors. I have no idea what that means. Some of what you experience is due to a change of season. Some of what you experience is a result of the neglect of body or from harsh treatment. And some of, a little bit of what you experience is a result of choices you have made. So kind of put it in perspective, isn't it, in terms of belief systems, you know, that slime ranks higher than choices you have made in your life. I think today sometimes, you know, I hear people say when they find themselves at in the midst of difficult circumstances they can't explain, they say, oh, well, it's just karma, with a kind of resignation. To put it simply, karma, in the Buddhist teaching, means to act. To act. This is what karma is. It is to act. And we are always engaged in actions. Actions of body, actions of speech, actions of mind. Even the choice not to speak or not to do something is acting and still karma. And actions leave footprints in our minds and on the world. And we live in a world that is imprinted by the acts of others, the acts of their body, speech, and mind, that also leave imprints upon us and upon the world. Now, many of the imprints of the acts we engage in, we can't predict. Others we can. A colleague of ours, Ruth Dennison, used to say, well, if you plant an apple tree seed, you're not going to get a mango tree. Now, the imprints or the consequences or the results of our action have a different name in Pali. They are called phala or vipaka, literally fruit or consequences. That's not karma. Huh? These are the consequences of acts. Now, interesting, both karma and the Pali word for compassion, which is karuna, have their root in the same Pali word, which is kriya, to act. Now, the Buddha took this word karma and defined it not as fatalism or determinism, because both of these are dissociative, but highlighted karma as responsibility and contribution rather than retribution. Right now, we're all engaged in karma. You know, we're acting. We might be thinking. In another moment, we might be speaking. We may move. We make choices about what we do with our bodies and our minds. And so karma is something very dynamic and very fluid. It's a present moment responsiveness. In many ways, karma is life. And if we wish the road in front of us to be not simply a rerun of the road behind us, then we're really asked to be aware of the ground that we stand on right now. Karma, our actions, do not arise from a vacuum. And the question is, what is moving? What is shaping excuse me, our actions, our speech, our thoughts, our choices? What shapes your decision to sit or not to sit? To walk or not to walk? What shapes your decision to go for a second plate of food at lunchtime or not? What shapes your choice to speak or to remain silent? What shaped your choice to come on retreat rather than to go skiing, apart from the fact that there's no snow? Is it really just an accident? Is it just an accident that we get lost in patterns of fantasy or obsession or judgment? So what we begin to sense is that our speech and our actions and our thoughts are always being shaped by something. It's not about good karma or bad karma, working out your karma. It's about what is shaping this moment. A story from the discourses where the Buddha comes across a man standing in the forest on one leg. And he's been standing there a long time. And the Buddha asks the man, he says, what are you doing? And the man answers, he says, I'm working out my karma. And the Buddha says, well, how much have you got rid of? And the man answers, he says, well, I have no idea. And the Buddha says, well, how much more have you got left to go? And the man answers, he says, I have no idea. And the Buddha says, well, how are you going to know when you're done? And the man answers, he says, I have no idea, you know. And it's one of those stories, of course, where the Buddha then goes into one of his, you know, rants about you foolish man on the wrong path and all of that. But clearly not about working on our karma or what working out our karma. I mean, there are thoughts and words and acts that have fruits that are immediately apparent. You know, if you go for the second plate of food, that you don't need and spend the afternoon in sloth and torpor and dullness, there might be a connection or beating yourself up for an hour for being indulgent. You know, there might be a connection here. If you find yourself speaking harshly and then you feel immediately the ripple of regret, then you know there is a connection. But many of the outcomes of our acts and our speech and our thoughts are really not immediately visible. It doesn't mean that they have no outcomes, but reveal the way that our thoughts and words and acts launch us into a world of conditions and people where they meet the thoughts and the words and the acts of others that are not of our making, that we don't control, where there's no certainties. We enter into a world of relationship, of society, of cultures that are also speaking and acting and thinking and making choices, and there's no certainties about the outcomes of our acts. You give money to someone who asks you for it on the street. You don't know how it will be used. We often have good intentions and really bad outcomes, you might have noticed. There's nothing linear about karma. And times it's presented, certainly in parts of the early teachings that I received, it was really sometimes presented in this really linear way. You know, like if you lie, you're going to get bad breath. Well, I've met lots of people who lie and they're perfectly sweet breath. So I just don't think that that makes necessarily a whole lot of sense. But our good intentions actually land in this world of conditions. You know, you think about someone like Mahatma Gandhi, you know, protesting against colonial rule. And despite his teachings of nonviolence, how much violence was unleashed in the aftermath of the partition of India. You think about Martin Luther King Jr., you know, who decried racism and racist societies and who also preached nonviolence. and how untold violence and cruelty were unleashed, not because his thoughts and words or acts were amiss, but because they landed in a world of conditions where others thought and acted and made choices that were in opposition. Every moment we stand on the road behind us we know, but the road in front of us is very uncertain. We stand on the road in the present with the imprint, though, of the road behind us, deeply embedded. You know, the entirety of our life is somehow embedded in our bones and often shaping how we are responding to the present. You know, the force of habit, I think, can become so powerful. And so, too, is the force of memory. The memories we have of injury or of pain or rejection, who we desperately want to seek to avoid in the present. But we also stand on the road in the present with our aspirations, with our longings, with our sense of possibilities of being free from distress, to be we stand on the road with our aspirations to be awake and thriving embodied human beings. We stand on the road in the present with our values around compassion, around integrity, around dignity, around freedom, the freedom to be no longer bound by the repetitive patterns that has not served us well. It's always so interesting how, you know, unhelpful habits seem to shadow us. You know, there may have been times in our lives where we found ourselves in habitual ways of acting and speaking and thinking that have actually brought safety or satisfaction in the past. You know, for a child who grows up, for example, in a cruel or an abusive household, you know, there's been patterns of defensiveness learnt that were survival patterns. You know, there may have been patterns of dissociation that were learnt, that were really survival patterns, that really served well at that point in their life, may have been helpful. You know, there may have been times in our lives where it's actually been kind of helpful to endeavor to build a narrative about who we are if we've been erased by the power of other people's voices. But our lives change, and somehow we find ourselves still practicing those habits when they no longer bring safety or no longer bring survival, but actually start to bring distress and disconnection. And we find in that simple truth that we are what we repeatedly do, that we become what we repeatedly do. I think we see it in the quote from the Buddha. It says, the thought manifests as the word manifests as the deed develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings. When we become what we repeatedly do, then we see the ways in which the past becomes our present and the way that our present shapes our future. I think sometimes we can feel quite helpless. And I think the question that we learn to hold most deeply in this path of waking up is really, how true is that sense of helplessness? Because we do see and really begin to see more and more clearly that mindfulness brings this unique gift of being able to choose where and how we establish our attention, where we make the home of our mind. You know, if you think about the qualities of kindness and compassion and joyfulness and equanimity, they're often talked about as being the Brahma-viharas. This word vihara means home, where we make the home of our mind. Choosing wisely takes considerable commitment and a considerable willingness to renew the intentions that serve us well. You know, when the Buddha speaks about wise intention, he has a very short list. You know, the list of the intention of kindness, the intention of compassion, and the intention of non-clinging. And if these intentions are really present in our life, then the words and the acts and thoughts that spring from them really only ever serve us well and serve others well. And yet intention really asks for that ongoing renewal. And it can only be renewed in the present and in the moment when we're really sensing what it is that are shaping our thoughts, speech, and acts. Thoreau put it, he says, as a single footstep will not make a path on earth, so a single thought will not make a pathway in the mind. To make a deep physical path, we walk over and over. To make a deep psychological path, we must think over and over the kind of thoughts we wish to dominate our lives. Now, the nature of unhelpful habits is that they have a sort of quality of forgetfulness built into them. Forgetfulness about wise intention. And have you noticed how easy it is to be quite forgetful? You know, that we might sit and walk with the intention to be awake and kind. You know, I'm sure most of you don't come into this room with the intention to dissociate or fall asleep or, you know, have a good 45 minutes of agitation and obsession. I doubt if anybody really does that, do they? You know, we probably come into this room with the intention to be as mindful as we can be, you know, as awake as we can be, as calm as we can be. Oh, isn't it shocking sometimes how short they last, those intentions, you know? Sometimes only moments before we find ourselves lost in judgment or lost in fantasy. And we also notice how that forgetfulness begins to be undone by the renewal of intention. And we actually begin to find there's a joyfulness in that renewal of intention. That returning to the home of kindness and compassion and non-clinging. And this is not only something that we practice on a cushion or on retreat. This is a practice for our lives. You know, notice with our speech, you know, most of us don't go out into our days, you know, with some kind of intention to be harsh and judgmental and cruel in our speech, you know. Most of us really have the intention to be reasonably sane human beings, you know. And yet, you know, we can meet the difficult person and, you know, doesn't it just seem like words just jump out of our mouth? You know, there's that wonderful quote from Tofu Roshi. She says, you know, I open my mouth and samsara jumps out. You know, this world of distress jumps out. But also we begin to notice how the renewal of intention, we begin to be able to sustain that much more. It doesn't feel so fragile. You know, we practice that renewal and we naturalize it and we naturalize that return to kindness and compassion, renunciation. And it becomes more naturalized, it becomes more accessible. And there's a great sense of freedom in that and the falling away of the forgetfulness. I think for me, karma is very much an ethical question. And it's not an ethical judgment. And I think it's so important to distinguish between those two. because this is actually what makes the difference between a path of cultivation and a view of fatalism or determinism. Karma is about choice and about what makes a difference. It's about, and it's not about punishment. This is what makes karma really an act of contribution, about how we are engaging with the world, both inwardly and outwardly. It raises a question about choosing our present, about choosing what shapes our speech, thoughts, and acts, knowing they need not be determined by the past, but by the values and the aspirations and the ethics that we hold dearly in the present. I think the Buddha really so clearly pointed out the dynamic nature of karma, encouraging us really to abandon the unskillful and to cultivate the skillful in body, speech, and mind. And what is unskillful? I think it's a good question. It is thoughts, acts, and choices that are really shaped by craving or ill will or clinging, because this is just like volunteering for suffering. It's like volunteering for suffering. And about really discovering that we have the power to choose the skillful, imbuing our thoughts, words, acts, and choices with kindness and compassion and non-clinging, because this is what leads to our thriving and the thriving of others. This is what leads towards understanding and freedom that benefits ourselves and others. The Buddha speaks a lot about coming out of wrong view and into a way of seeing that is aligned with the way things actually are. And, when he talks about wrong view, he says, part of wrong view is imagining that we just live in a universe of random events, that life just happens to us. No, life doesn't just happen to us. All things arise from conditions, both inwardly and outwardly. Some of them we cannot control, but we are certainly not helpless in this life about the conditions we cultivate inwardly and that which we contribute to the world. And in this time in our world, in the situation we're in, when there is so much conflict, when we live within, a climate emergency, when there's so much injustice and so much alienation, it really does make a difference to be aware of, what are we really contributing? Because we're always contributing something. And this is not about prescriptions. We know we cannot guarantee where our speech and our thoughts and our acts will land. But we can begin to really have a sense of where they rise from, what their roots are. And develop in that, I think, really a commitment to healing, a commitment to liberation. And I think that reflection, really can only happen in the moment, on the road that we stand on, that we learn actually to be embodied human beings. Intention is not just, wise intention is not just about a good idea. It is actually about what we live. And there's a lot of, I think there's something quite fearless and that commitment to developing, having ourselves rooted in kindness and compassion and non-clinging, when so many of the messages we receive are just the opposite. I think it takes great courage to stand on the road that we're on with those commitments inwardly. But we really sense and know the difference that they make, both inwardly and outwardly. A couple of years ago, and some of you have been on this retreat with us before, will remember me talking about taking on the intention not to have any more neutral people in my life. This remains really juicy for me. Some of you weren't around, it's not that I go out seeking neutral people, but there's a lot of people who come into my life, serve me on trains or in restaurants or in hotels, you know, and to really see people, to really see people with kindness. And I got to tell you, my relationship with the doorman of the hotel in London has flourished so much, you know, that we've become real buddies, you know. I mean, I'm really involved in their lives now. And it makes such a difference. It actually makes such a difference. I want to end with a piece from Goethe. It says, "I have come to the frightening conclusion that I am the decisive element. It's my personal approach that creates the climate. It's my daily mood that makes the weather. I possess tremendous power to make life miserable or joyous. I can be a tool of torture or an instrument of inspiration. I can humiliate or humor, hurt or heal. In all situations, it is my response that decides whether a crisis is escalated or de-escalated and a person humanized or dehumanized."